All right, thank you. I hate sports analogies, but isn't this batting cleanup or something like that? I don't know. Anyway, I'm really happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation. It's been really interesting so far to see the commonalities and the differences in the different regions. So I wish I'd put in a little bit of information about the history of high tunnels in the Northeast, but it's a really long history. My predecessor, Otho Wells, was doing work in high tunnels back in the 80s, and growers were using them at that time. So it's been interesting to see some of the shifts. So just for a little orientation, we have just as many states that I'm going to be talking about, but they're all much smaller. So it's a little tiny area up in the Northeast, but we have a lot of climate diversity. So we're from zones 3A to 7A, if I count New England, although I will admit some of my tunnel pictures are from upstate New York as well. And just to orient you, we do our work at UNH in Durham, which is where that red square is. So it's really on the very southeastern corner of the state of New Hampshire. It's really it's the mildest part of the state there. So I organized what I was going to show you in kind of a whirlwind tour, but I'm going to really focus on, like others have, the dominant structures, crops, and production systems that are in use in the Northeast. Show you some pictures of some emerging or innovative technologies that mostly growers are using. Touch on briefly some production issues limiting efficiency, and then finish up with what I see as the big training and research needs in the Northeast particularly. So this is very similar to some of the other slides you've seen. We do not have excellent high tunnel acreage estimates. So this top table here is from a survey that Ted Carey did back in 2009, and I remember the phone call. So he called extension folks from around the country and asked us, so how many tunnels do you think there are in your state? I mean, it might have been an email, but I don't put a lot of stock in my ability. I didn't put a lot of stock in my ability to estimate at that time. And I see that there's tremendous variation, and we have a lot of states in the region for which there just weren't estimates. So, and sometimes they were vague, such as Connecticut's "oh, hundreds" response, which kind of cracked me up. So at that time, you know, we were looking at an estimate of 60, 80 acres in New England of high tunnels, maybe a little more. The current data from New Hampshire's NRCS, and we're just such a tiny state, is that in the last 10 years, we had another 25 acres or so, which sounds very small, but is actually quite significant for our small state. So that's almost 500 of the new 30x72, which is our standard NRCS size tunnels. But I would say it's a challenge actually not knowing quite how many tunnels there are, because it's hard to estimate sort of the impacts of the kind of work we could do in these structures. So we've looked at a lot of kinds of tunnels, and I'm going to show you some examples, but we've been talking about all these different aspects of the construction. And I will say in New England, almost all of the frames are steel, although there are some growers using low-tech PVC, very temporary structures. We have a full mix of covering ranges, polyethylene, so one layer or two layer. I will say that in almost all cases, those who are using double layers are inflating for wind protection, because having two flopping around is not particularly stable. And a lot of the decision between one layer or two has to do with whether they're growing in the winter or not. But we see both. We also see both manual and automatic ventilation strategies omnipresent in all kinds of tunnels. There's no one choice there. And we see all combinations of heating, none to emergency portable heaters that are brought in for very early season production, rescue situations in case of a frost, to straight up supplemental heating and intentional heating through the winter. We also see mostly stationary tunnels, although I'll show you some pictures of some movable ones. And while we see a range of substrates, meaning imported soil or hydroponic or bucket production in tunnels and native soil, it's almost exclusively native soil production in ground. And we are almost exclusively seeing standalone structures, although there are some using multi-bay kinds of structures. So this is the typical structure in the Northeast. We expect snow loads. We expect significant snow loads. And we expect occasional severe wind, but occasional depending on the site. So these are almost exclusively Gothic structures and very sturdy with solid end walls, usually metal or wood end walls. And growers, these are well suited to year-round production, although I will echo that most growers, well, many are not using them for that purpose. So this is the same structure covered. And here you can see that there are actually mechanical ventilation fans. There's vents on one end, fans on the other. And I didn't see a lot of that in the other presentations, but for those who do have access to electricity, that is a pretty common insurance strategy for if you're not there to raise those roll-up sides when it heats up. That is very typical, and we encourage growers to do that if they can. So we do have a lot of lightweight, inexpensive tunnels that are not well suited to year-round production and that we do not suggest that growers use for year-round production, although you can maybe see in that bottom left one, that grower is using them for year-round production. So these are temporary, we call them caterpillar tunnels. They are for three-season use. They're just rain shelters in our very humid area where we do get rain. And rain protection is a significant advantage of the tunnels. So the one on the right is actually bent steel hoops, but they're just temporarily put in the ground. The one on the top left is PVC, just temporarily erected over the crop. That's on a commercial farm where the grower says, yep, the wind takes them apart every few, you know, maybe a couple times a season, but they're cheap to put right back up again. And so they accept that kind of the limitation of this structure. Several folks have mentioned hay groves, and we do have a limited number of hay groves in the Northeast. Site selection is really important. They are mostly being used for berry crops, like raspberries or tomatoes in some cases, but for perennial crops where covering through just the summer is important. Definitely not the typical structure, but for anybody using any acreage, the cost is appealing compared with the sturdier structures. We see a lot of tunnel collapse, and it is sometimes due to snowfall and not having adequately prepared to remove that snow, but increasingly we have tremendous amounts of rain and wind in the shoulder seasons, and at that time, even well-installed tunnels in liquefied soil will pull out and move. That is a challenge that growers face in the Northeast for sure. So just talking about dominant crops and stuff, systems that are being used as part of a Northeast SARE project focused on northern New England. We did a survey of tunnel growers a couple of years ago, and we got about 16 acres worth of tunnels covered in the responses to this, about half organic, half conventional. We think it's pretty representative of growers in the Northeast. We got pretty good estimates of the kinds of things growers are doing in tunnels, and it's the kinds of things you heard earlier in the previous talks. But you can see down in the bottom here, this is the spring production. This is what they're saying they're growing in the summer, and this is in the fall, and this is the winter. So looking at winter here, it's really alliums, herbs, and greens, primarily spinach, over the winter. And in the summer, they're really looking at tomatoes, peppers, cucurbits, and then some assorted other things. A lot of our growers in the spring are using them for transplants, herbs, and early season warm weather crops. But there's this tremendous variation of other crops people are growing in tunnels, from ginger to cut flowers to perennial crops, strawberries, blackberries, etc. You can see the list on the bottom there. This is the typical situation in the Northeast: indeterminate tomatoes in the summer, followed by a very cold hardy crop like spinach during the winter months, if they choose to grow year-round in their tunnel. And you'll note that it is in-ground in both cases here. But this is kind of a range of what we see. We do see cucumber production, fair amount of cucurbits. This was the top right picture was a first for me. That's a tunnel full of broccoli. I took that picture last week. Thought that's unusual choice in a tunnel in the Northeast where we don't really need the heat. This tunnel in the bottom right is a tunnel of eggplant, and I want to point that out because that's using insect netting to keep out Colorado potato beetle, and very, very effective. And then greens on the bottom left. We do have a fair amount of fruit crop production. These are pictures from New Hampshire, Vermont, and also upstate New York. So the bottom left, we've got some blackberries. We have some containerized raspberries up in the top left. We have in-ground raspberries in the top right. And then that bottom tunnel is on the right is a hay grove with in-ground strawberries in it. So it's really quite a full range of crops being grown. But actually, you're just as likely, if you're visiting the typical grower in our region, to find that their tunnel is full of everything they could fit in there. And you can see this is a combo of, what is that, cucumbers, transplants, hydroponic strawberry, and there's probably some tomatoes somewhere in there. That's really typical. So technological advances-wise, others have mentioned, but I'll echo, that the big one for winter growing is supplementary protection with row cover in various kinds of strategies. And like you can see here, we see all different configurations of that, in some cases supported over individual hoops, sometimes covering the entire greenhouse to make it a little easier to take it on and off. Many of our growers that are growing in the winter are providing some supplemental heat, meaning they're just bumping it up to about 35 degrees, maybe 40, to avoid the injury that you get when it freezes on those high-value greens. It also improves the logistics of harvesting because it's difficult to harvest a quality greens crop when it's frozen. We do see growers using supplemental light and supplemental CO2, but it's rare. I know of two, and the pictures are here. So the bottom left is a tomato grower using LEDs, and the top right is a greens grower with typical high-pressure sodium lights, and he was using CO2 enrichment. And we have no really good idea of whether those are worth it or not. They're just doing it.
So the other thing I wanted to point out, Becky, is the novel planting, because that's at Paul's,
right? Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's an unusual.
So that's where the person, so the way this farmer does it, he's a landscaper, but he has tunnels to keep his employees through the winter. And they're basically sharecroppers. They get to keep any profits that they get. So one of his people figured out he has much more planting area. He just has a 1 foot square little place to stand to harvest. And the next place to stand to harvest is as far as he can step.
Yeah, they kind of jump from place to place to place.
And so yeah. 90% of that house is in greens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Beg your pardon. On the lower left, you have a little piece of PVC above the purlins between the ribs. See all those?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Is that to keep the plastic taut? Because is that what all that is? So it doesn't rub on the...
You know, that is an excellent question. I don't think so. It's below the poly. I do not know why they're there. He had actually a lot of unusual engineering modifications. And I had actually taken, I was going to add a few more pictures. And then as I was putting this talk together, I thought, wait, I don't even get how that works. So I took it out. And that may be one of those other weird modifications. I'm not sure what he was doing there. That's a good question. I know, we should. So I want to mention movable high tunnels quickly. So we do have an increasing number of growers using movable tunnels. And the one on the top here is evident that it's movable, although the system on which it moves is not so clear. That's actually one of Elliot Coleman's designs in his tunnels. The one on the bottom right is currently a commercially available Rimmel tunnel. And you can see, even though it looks like it's a picture of low tunnels, they're just in the foreground, it really rolls on rails there. Folks have mentioned the need for roof venting, so we do have some growers adding roof vents for additional summer ventilation. We have growers innovating and adding netting, especially if they're doing berry production. So this is an SWD solution, so pretty effectively keeping SWD out of berry production. We also see odd crop choices, so we see a lot of insectary plantings, so attracting biological controls naturally. And this grower on the large picture there is growing actually green beans as an insectary plant, as a monitoring plant, and also for crop on the edge of his tomato house. We also have some use of netting to exclude birds, and anybody who's worked in tunnels knows that birds present sometimes a significant food safety concern because they love to nest on those trellising systems in there. And we've also seen some unusual situations with trying to capture heat either in water or in the ground. I'm assuming I don't have any time left. I'm out of time. Okay. Well, there we go. I will just zip to the very end here and say I'm going to the way end because all of these things we've talked about, I will say if I can for 1 second, that the challenges with these new tunnel growers are not the same as with our really experienced tunnel growers. And so I think that sometimes it's really difficult from an extension standpoint and a research standpoint to really address these needs together because they're different groups. And often the challenges with the new growers are just like awareness of how to even manage tunnels. So it's really a different kind of thing. But I'll finish with this optimistic end that I think there's tons of good opportunities for collaboration because we have a lot of shared challenges across all the regions. I'll finish there.
We are almost officially out of time, but I am going to open the floor for questions and discussion for 10 minutes, and then we're going to transition into a commercial horticulture extension interest group business meeting, if anyone wants to stay around for that for 10 minutes. But I think we rarely get this many people together in the same room that work with tunnels in so many different parts of the country. So now it's time is to ask the questions that you have. I learned a lot of new things. Hopefully you did as well. I never thought that tunnel growers were overwatering crops, but I've never been to the arid intermountain region, so that may be the case, but the Mid-Atlantic, we're just facing the opposite problem. So any pressing interest, question, something that we want to go deeper in depth on? Yeah. I don't know if it's just a logistical issue of, in our case, we're able to access the NRCS database. It's a confidential client list, but we're able to access that the survey. So we do have their estimates. The best you can do is probably estimate beyond that what your other growers who have purchased high tunnels from, private capital sources or whatever. But I mean, I think, you know, it's just a matter of going out there and accessing the NRCS database. 80% of our high tunnels in West Virginia are NRCS funded. I don't know if that's the case in other states, but that would be a pretty good estimate if you could access their database for your state. But it's an evolving technology, and there's, you know, dozens and dozens of growers each year in your states probably adding high tunnels. But any, yeah,
in our state, the NRCS is not leading the share. That's the problem there.
Okay. Yeah, this arrangement with NRCS is state by state. You know, it's personality driven, and you know, I know that some of the land grants don't really work as closely with them, but I think it's important to have some sort of relationship with that agency at some level because they are intricately involved in this program, and quite frankly, they could mess it up. I mean, they could make recommendations, as somebody alluded to, that they could make site recommendations. They can make cropping recommendations that just totally mess everybody up. So we need to sort of be connected to them so that we're training their personnel and we're getting them their educational levels up, because many of their field people are not horticulturists, and they need that type of training. Yeah.
Well, along that line, my question for the group is, do we know why the NRCS does not allow container production in an NRCS tunnel?
Well, it's not a soil. I mean, there's a soil conservation agency, so I think they want, you know, a soil-based system because, you know, they're really trying to – really what they're trying to quantify whether these tunnels are being used for, you know, nutrient management, you know, and soil conservation. So – they felt they didn't want to go out of native soil.
But the validation for the payment system is for crop protection. It's for risk management. That's where the money comes from, is for risk management.
You're right.
And the reason I'm asking is because my Alaska growers, maybe we've got somebody else here from Alaska, but they really would benefit by being able to do container production rather than soil production.
And well, it's a three-year contract. I mean, it's not, you know,
right.
a long...
But I guess it brings us back to the point where if we have the opportunity to provide NRCS with some suggestions about what might make sense for the program...
Yeah. Well, I agree.
I think that puts us in a place where we can really think about what some guidelines are that we might suggest. And, you know, we can't, of course, make them do anything, but just providing some guidance, what we think might be beneficial.
Yeah, I've been told, at least in Texas, I've been told in Texas that you just had a grower who qualified for two high tunnels with NRCS, and I asked them what the restrictions were, and they said they didn't have any restrictions.
It's state by state.
Yeah, so it must be state by state.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
I was just going to say that I thought it was under the Environmental Quality Incentives Program that the money comes from, which is totally different from Risk Management Agency. So I didn't understand how it's coming through risk management. So my understanding of why you have to grow in soil, if you read the rationale for why they're even funding it, it's for, you know, reduced pesticide use,
right.
runoff,
nutrient retention,
Impetus behind us putting together that information because they wanted that information for the program. So I'm just going based on that. So in Maine, I got money from NRCS to do a similar kind of study, but it was to document soil health and runoff. And that's what they were looking for.
Right. My experience with them, they're a very flexible agency to work with. They are considering cost sharing on movable high tunnels, which they didn't think they would do at the first. They seem to be flexible on advice, you know, certainly if it's research-based advice. I found them you know, a little less bureaucratic than some other agencies. I invited some of the personnel USDA here. I think they're in transition. The program leader for that program, seasonal high tunnel program, I think just retired, so they're in transition from finding new staff. But anyway, I find them to be a flexible agency to work with, and as much as we can work with them, I think is valuable. You know, so any pressing environmental issues in these tunnels that you feel are we can talk in 1 minute about?
Sorry, yeah. Really
yeah, soil compaction. I mean, how many folks are doing work with cover cropping in high tunnels? Okay, so, you know, we have a no-till system set up for high tunnel production that is, you know, similar to what you're doing in Maine with the tarp system for terminating crops. It works very well in high tunnels. So, you know, the less tillage, the less grinding, the less, you know, all that, I think will solve that issue. So, I mean, you know, we have growers that are putting permanent raised beds in their high tunnels, so maybe just back it up west to, or I mean Russ, to another system of tillage for the strawberries and less primary tillage.
So you're there for 8 months, so you're walking between those rows for 8 months. So maybe throw some crops in between.
Yeah, I think you could do, you know, living mulches in between the in the walk path would be an option. But I think, you know, definitely getting the growers aware of soil health is very, very important. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question. I'm just curious, for all the people, I'm just curious if most of the growers actually build their high tunnels by themselves, or they actually have a contractor to work with to help them to install the high tunnels. I'm just very curious because I personally see the huge difference in terms of the cost.
Yeah. Well, it's 50% of the total cost could be the construction costs alone, which sort of stuns the growers when they get these high tunnels. There is a market for contractors for high tunnel construction. We talked about vets to ag. Returning vets should probably invest in construction companies for high tunnels. I think that would be a good market opportunity. But in the Mid-Atlantic, there are a few. They're mostly Amish, Mennonite-owned companies that have construction crews. But they are backlogged for months and months, so it's been a big issue for our growers. And not only construction, but site preparation, where the grower has to come in and level the site. Certainly in Appalachia, we have a lot of slope ground, so the site has to be terraced. So that takes money and time, and the growers are a little unprepared for that as well. But
in my area, the growers do all the work. I don't know of any contractor in my
We have one of our longest standing tunnel growers she's got a big family of big strapping boys, and they've now built tunnels for other people, and one of them's a mechanical engineer, so they actually do really good job.
Great.
I want to kind of make a comment or explore this a little bit more. You talked about the level of expertise, and we see kind of both ends of the spectrum. We see people that are experienced growers that know how to grow a crop but now want to do tunnels, and people that have never grown maybe even a garden. and so we've had kind of a struggle with how to address that clientele because we have a very big divide. And we've had to, some of our workshops, we have a beginning grower and an advanced grower. We try to separate them out to get so that they can ask the kind of questions at the level they're at. But I'm wondering, I would guess that's pretty typical or not so.
In Mississippi, if I can speak to Mississippi for a minute, we have some grower cooperatives with a lot of gardeners in them that are even co-op and that really don't grow. And they're doing some peer-to-peer stuff, and we're doing some very separate training from them, from the up and farms, from the private sector level. And there's another couple private groups that are doing some training. And that may be one way to separate to get some peer-to-peer so that they can grow each other up. Really difficult for the small growers that need every piece of hand holding it.
Well, if I can ask a follow-up question, did you say that you have a curriculum for?
Yeah, we have a high tunnel production manual. I think several states do. Use that as a curriculum for a 12-16 week training course. It's everything from reading a soil test up to fertigation, you know, and beyond. So I thought that all these growers who went through this NRCS application process should have been required to go through a training program like that. And that should have been developing a business plan as well, but that's, we're past that already. But we're just trying to reboot the system a little bit. And I think in our case, in Appalachia, we have just a tidal wave of new growers. I mean, we have some experienced, but the vast majority are brand new. So we're just trying to get them all on the same footing. And we're hoping we can replicate this class to other conservation districts. That's how our tunnels are grouped by conservation district. And so we'll do the training in different conservation districts, use experienced growers as educators, as teachers as well, but also other county extension personnel, myself, maybe some NRCS personnel. But I think, you know, you might have to just back it up and start with some just basic core training on principles of crop production, especially crop production, undercover. But I mean, you know, I would recommend you probably use, your regional production guides as a framework for your curriculum.
Is your manual online?
It will be. Everything is pending with me, so it will be online. So yeah, we have moved to a new website, so that will be up. But yeah, I mean, so your publications, and mine can maybe supplement each other to develop a curriculum for that.
Yeah. So another follow-up question is, what's happening with hightunnels.org? Is that still to go to?
Well, Kerry's not here, so I can't speak for him. I mean, you know, it still has been a foundation of knowledge for a lot of growers across the, I still recommend my growers to access it. I think, you know, he tries to keep it relevant and updated. But I think we're to the point now where we have to have our own state websites and our own state listservs. I mean, I love getting feedback from growers in the Midwest on things that we should be doing in the Mid-Atlantic, but I think sometimes we just need to sort of bring it home, you know. So, but I think it's a great website, right? I mean, your growers in the Northwest use it, or
I point people to it, but I have to honestly say I haven't looked at it myself in a while, so I just wasn't quite sure if it was still active.
Well, the listserv is very active.
It was actively providing links to publications, and I confess I just haven't looked.
Yeah, honestly, I haven't looked at it probably in 4 or 5 months, but I think, you know, it's a good starting point for growers to get information about these crops, and, you know, there's some economic information on there as well. So, but yeah, I mean, I think we can all learn from each other. We can, anything that you want to do collaboratively in the future related to high tunnels, this is the beginning of the network here of people that you would want to work with. So this could be an extension program. It could be applied research program. But I'm happy to work with you. I think some of my other colleagues are happy as well. And we just want to keep this information flowing, keep updated, keep connected, and, you know, just help these growers along so that this becomes a successful program, because we want more local food in our states and our counties, and this is the way to do it, but we just need to be present, and that's what Extension does. So I thank everybody for being here, and if there is a survey that you did, please return it to me, and we'll compile those and sort of get an idea of what the general feeling of some of the most pressing issues for high tunnel production are. And any other issues that you have related to horticulture extension, high tunnel, not high tunnel, I'm happy to hear about. And if you want to stay around for the Horticulture Extension meeting, you're welcome to do that. But it's been probably a long week for everybody, and you're probably thinking about leaving. So thanks for everybody for showing up. I appreciate it. All right.